Hello, I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. The 29th of June is a holiday here in Rome, and everyone knows why. It's the day the church remembers the feast of Saints Peter and Paul. So, as promised, in a few moments we'll be joining scripture scholar Mark Coleridge, Archbishop of Canberra and Goulburn in Australia, who tells us why the church celebrates these two apostles together rather than independently. And here in Rome, they're visibly never without one another. If you go into St. Paul's, there's St. Peter. If you go into St. Peter's, there's St. Paul. But the question is, they fought mightily in their lifetime. So what brought them so close together?
One of the most striking things about the city of Rome, one of the many striking things, is that it's not just that it's the city of St. Peter and Paul, as if you see Peter in some parts and Paul in other parts. In fact, wherever you go in the city, you never see Peter unless you see Paul, and you never see Paul unless you see Peter. They're always together. You walk into St. Paul's outside the walls, and there, standing up in the front of the basilica, are big statues of both Peter and Paul. Similarly, you walk into Piazza San Pietro, and again you see heroic statues of the two of them. Not only do we see them represented together like that around the city, but in the church around the world. We celebrate their feast day on one day, 29th of June. And the question is, why don't we have a day for them each? Aren't they important enough, surely, to warrant a day? And yet, here we have them celebrated together in one city on one day. Now, this becomes all the more peculiar and interesting when you recognise that in life they fought, and they fought about things that weren't just trivial but went to the very heart of what Christianity and the church are. The first time that Paul meets Peter is in those years after his Damascus Road encounter, when he's knocked down, stripped of power, and when he hears the call to be the apostle to the non-Jewish world. After that encounter on the road to Damascus, Paul vanishes into what he calls Arabia for quite some time, and then eventually emerges from the desert to undertake a mission, his first ever mission, perhaps, in Damascus. Again, his life is under attack immediately. He's lowered down the wall in a basket, and away he goes. And then beyond that experience of mission in Damascus, he decides to go up to Jerusalem. Now, for Paul, this was a very delicate moment because he was known to be a persecutor of the church. But he felt he had to go up and meet those whom he calls the pillars of the church. He met Peter, James and John. He calls Peter Kephas, which was Peter's name in Aramaic. Same nickname, means rock. But Peter, James and John were the big three, the Troika, in Jerusalem. So Paul, at this moment, is driven, as it were, to go up and meet them, whom he had almost certainly never met before. Now, he needs a diplomatic bridge, someone who can introduce him to a community who were still highly suspicious of the former persecutor. And the diplomatic bridge he finds is the crucial figure in his life of Barnabas, real name Joseph. Barnabas was his nickname, son of encouragement. He must have been that sort of man. So Barnabas it is who takes Paul to meet Peter. And in his letter to the Galatians, Paul says that I went up to Jerusalem to, the word he uses in Greek is historesai, to historesai Peter. Now, this verb in Greek can mean two things. It can mean to give information to or to receive information from. I think Paul uses this verb precisely to say, I wanted to hear something from Peter and I wanted Peter to hear something from me. Now, what did he want to hear from Peter? He wanted to hear about Jesus. Paul had never met Jesus. I think when you read the letters, that's clear. He never knew Jesus personally, but Peter most certainly did. So he needs to hear a lot from Peter about the historical Jesus, who he was, what he did, what he said. Peter needs to hear from Paul, the real story from the horse's mouth, as it were, of Paul's own conversion. So here they are, the two of them, for about a fortnight in Jerusalem, exchanging information, telling their stories to each other. Paul then vanishes from the scene. He goes home to Tarsus for a long time, and at this stage he could have plummeted off into the black hole of history. But in fact he doesn't, because again it's Barnabas who brings him back onto the stage as one of the leadership team of Antioch, where the gospel was first preached to non-Jews, to Gentiles. Barnabas was the one sent down from Jerusalem to discern this volcanic and potentially dangerous situation where the gospel is moving out of Judaism into the Gentile world. Barnabas needs to recruit the right kind of leaders, and he thinks Paul. So he goes to Tarsus, finds Paul, brings him back to Antioch, and there for about a year, we're told, Paul is part of the teaching team, the leadership team. Then he becomes part of the first ever Christian mission team to leave Palestine and enter the Mediterranean world. Barnabas was the leader of that first ever mission. Paul's the kind of vice captain, and John Mark is the third member of the team. They again preach the good news of Jesus to non-Jews out there in the Mediterranean world, and this creates enormous controversy in the infant church. And as a result, when they come back to Antioch, they have to go up to Jerusalem, again, to meet with the mother church in this moment of crisis and controversy. So Paul and Barnabas go up, and again Paul meets Peter in what's called the Council of Jerusalem. And it's Peter who eventually stands up and delivers a kind of compromise judgment, really, that the gospel is for the Gentiles, but the Gentiles need to respect Jewish sensibilities on certain counts. So here again, a second moment where Paul meets Peter. And Paul, like everyone else in the early church, deferred to the unique authority that Peter had received from Jesus himself. No one doubted that, certainly not Paul. The third time, and in some ways the last time that Paul meets Peter, is again in Antioch, where Peter has come down and he's sharing table fellowship with non-Jews, non-Jewish Christians. Jewish Christian and Gentile Christian sitting down at one table. Now this undermined the fundament of Jewish religious identity, which was separation of the Jewish and Gentile worlds. Now you had Peter and Paul sitting down as Jewish Christians with non-Jewish Christians, sitting at the one table to eat and to celebrate the Eucharist, therefore. Some of the James Party, as they're called, some of the conservative Jewish Christians from Jerusalem, James was the residential leader of the church in Jerusalem, come down and they say, you can't eat with them. You Jewish Christians have to separate. We have one church, two tables. And Paul says, no, wrong way, go back. You are re-erecting the barriers that God has knocked down in Jesus. Therefore, you are doing the work of Satan. At this stage, Peter and Barnabas agree with the James people who have come down from Jerusalem, and Paul looks a very isolated figure. He has to make a decision. He could have either gone home to Tarsus, just said, it's a bad joke, I'm out of here, or he could have said, well, you were right and I'm wrong, I beg your pardon, I didn't want to create all the trouble. Or, and this is what he does in fact, he could decide to set up his own mission team. So what comes to birth in this brawl at Antioch is the independent Pauline mission. And the issue that Paul and Peter fight about is really the nature of the church. Is the church a kind of sect within Judaism? Or has it been born from the womb of the synagogue as some new, distinctive initiative of God's? Paul says that Christianity is not just part of Judaism. It has been born, thrust forth, as it were, from the womb of the synagogue as something new that God is doing for all people, not just for Jews, but for Gentiles as well. At that stage, Peter and Paul part ways. Paul will reappear in Jerusalem from time to time, but we don't exactly know what went on there. He will never again return to Antioch as he sets forth on the path of his independent mission. Eventually, the stories of Peter and Paul will converge. Their paths will cross in the most decisive way, because both of them were among the Christian leaders in Rome in the mid-60s who were swept away in the tide of blood that came with the persecution of the Emperor Nero. So both suffer a martyr's death, that much is certain. Paul is beheaded on the way out to Ostia, at what is now Trefontane. Peter is crucified in what was Caligula's circus, and that is now St. Peter's Square. Now, what happens in this moment is that in the moment of their death, and Rome is the city of their death, they didn't found the church in Rome, but they died here. In the moment of their death, they find their way so completely and so profoundly to Jesus, crucified and risen, that they find their way to one another. That's the key. They find a communion in Jesus, crucified and risen, in their death, that they didn't and couldn't find in their life. So, why does the church celebrate the memory of the two of them so intensely in one city, where they're always represented together, and celebrate their memory particularly on one day, the 29th of June? Because in this, the city of their death, they become so completely, as it were, immersed in Jesus. They become Jesus, crucified and risen, that they move beyond all their differences and disagreements to find their way into that perfect communion, which is in Jesus, crucified and risen. And that's why the Petrine ministry, the papacy, looks not just to Peter, but also to Paul, because the Pope, as heir to the witness of both Peter and Paul, the Bishop of Rome, is the prime servant of the communion which they found in death.
And a big thank you there to scripture scholar Mark Coleridge, Archbishop of Canberra and Goulburn in Australia. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick.